one, too.
Well, this thing is not catching you, is it? And you're talking over there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It'll catch you, too.
Yeah. Maybe just start off, you give me your full name and where you were born, and when you were born. And can we just talk a little bit about what you did before you went to Granville?
Very good, then I can do that.
Okay,
well, I was born at Horde. And then Horde, H-O-R-O-D. The reading material in the prison camp, where will you get it? There's nothing there, you see. Definitely not. They're laying down anyway, whether they're cutting their hair or they're laying down in their bunk or sitting outside out in the sun, you see. That didn't matter anyway because you weren't doing anything. You know, during the time that we were in North Point, in Shamshipu, the fellas that were, you know, farm. And for the same particular fellow, I went trucking, I think at about 14 years of age already, I did steer the truck. And then I went into the relief camps at Clear Lakes, or stay there for the winter.
This would be in the 30s?
That's in the 30s, 36.
When were you born, what year?
1918. Yeah. And that's 36, so I wasn't too old then. Working for $5 a month there. Well, actually, it was 20 cents a day. And the following year, I went to Nipua at 16 years of age. And I worked for a farmer there for 8 months at $15 a month. And that was harvest come in at about 4 o'clock in the morning, sunrise, we were out, and about 11 o'clock before we get into bed.
Was this a threshing outfit?
That was the threshing outfit. At that time, there was only a few threshers, you see, and this guy, he went out, and we stayed like that for a whole month threshing for different farmers, you see. Oh, yes, and then I came back the following year. I went back out to the farm. No, I went riding freight going east to Ontario. Stayed there for a year in bush camps. Fort William and Nipigon, Ontario. That's about as far as we went. I came back and got into these bush camps down there.
Did you go with somebody else?
Well, to start with, there was lots of us from here, you know. Everybody was looking for a buck the same thing as I was, so the lucky ones got a job and the lucky ones came back home. But I spent a couple of years there, I think it was like that. And I came back and I went back to the fellow that was herding cattle. He got a cream truck, Menadosa Creamery, and then I went on that cream truck for 2 years. And he had a truck of his own. I used to haul grain and wood for him, which paid my board staying there. And then the creamery paid him, $60 a month? And he paid me $15 a month. That was good wage. I was doing all his work. This is the setup that used to be years ago, you see. And after, just catch on to what was going on later on. Yeah, I stayed with that cream truck, and then the creamery finally gave me the cream run all to myself. Well, they knew what was going on, that the fellow was only paying out of their wages. And I stayed with them till I was called to the army, you see. To 21 years of age, which my basic training was in Brannan. Then I came home after that, and then I was called up again.
What regiment was that?
Well, Brannan. It's an infantry, you know, because it was basic training. It's only an infantry anyway, so it was just
wasn't the Grenadiers at that time?
Oh no.
It was just basic training.
Everybody 21 years of age for that 1 month. They called them. Any boys around here, there was this was conscription. You had to go and there was no other result.
Was it a military officer come into the district?
They sent notes out and you had to go and register at a certain time because if you didn't, the guys would be out here just as shameless. You have to be there and that's all there was to it. So the following year, I went back to the cream run and the following July, then I was called up to Portage. Basic training, you see. We stayed there, 3 months in Portage. July, August, September. 3 months anyway. In October, we were in Fort Osmond Barracks, you see. And I don't think that I was there, that I was there 3 weeks. So this big fella comes up and asks the boys whether they'd like to spend a winter in West Coast, you see. So I and my chum over here, he come from here too. So he said, by God, you know, after over a beer, you know, the smokers used to be. So he says, well, boy, no use of freezing here for the winter. Let's go to the West Coast. And, you know, we just stopped over like that night. And the next morning, it was 10 o'clock, we have a coffee break. So, and, of course, in the meantime, they're registering all these fellas already. So I said, well, have you been up there? No. So we just said like that, and I sort of forced myself and him into it, or me, him, over a talk like that. So I went up and registered, and he did too. So before we knew it, 2 weeks later, they had another smoker, and this was a little different in speech. They asked any volunteers for direct overseas service, and this is what we were in already. In that, there was no such a thing as a West Coast service.
Did you know who it would be with at that time?
We didn't know a thing, no, we didn't know, but we knew already that was a strict overseas, and we didn't know who it was. We didn't know till we actually, only a few days before that, when we were drafted back I just forgot the name of the place that we were bunched together, just after we had our holiday, and then we had to meet up at a certain building.
In Winnipeg?
In Winnipeg.
Maybe the Robinson Building?
Mentor armies, you see, and that's where we weren't there too long. I think only about a week together like that. And we knew we were Winnipeg Grenadiers, and then we knew that we met up with the fellows from Jamaica. Of course, these fellows, they were there 16 months, I believe, in Jamaica.
Yeah. What kind of training did you take them? Was it
infantry
training?
Well, we had the basic training here for 1 month, and then we had the same setup in Portage, you see, was the infantry basic training.
Marching and drill?
Yeah, drill and marching, and actually going up firing your guns, but, you know, it only mattered of 3 months of training, that's all I had.
Right.
From that time till the time I was going overseas. But I think there was fellows there that only had about a month.
So anyway, you ended up in the did you find that you fit in the Grenadiers? I know some of the men who went in as reinforcements said that there was a little bit of resentment towards them, to some of them from the Grenadiers who'd been in Jamaica and they'd been in for a long time and all.
Yeah, and we were sort of a trainees, naturally.
Right.
They were in the army that much longer, you know, the fellas as were overseas and came back, which we haven't been any place. It's just like me coming out of the fireman, getting in with you guys, that you already in harness in a long time before I was. Well, I guess it was. But, you know, it didn't last that long to make the difference because, like I said, we were bunched together and then we were boarded on that train and into Vancouver. And that,
did you know where you were going when you got on the train?
We didn't know where we were going. I knew we were going to the West Coast. And we knew we weren't going to Germany. That's one thing. We knew we were either going to China, New Zealand, Singapore. But this was a guess. Nobody knew a thing.
Had you been issued any equipment of any kind by the Grenadiers?
Well, yes, we had, your rifles and your equipment as usual, the army equipment, and your bags and all that. And so that's the way we were, like I said, we went over to Vancouver, and that's for all we knew. We figured we'd probably stop there for a week, but this thing wasn't. It just unload off the train onto the boat, you see. This is what it was.
Do you remember anything about the train trip going out to Vancouver?
The train?
Train from Winnipeg out to Vancouver. Any incidents that you remember on the train?
Well, not too much. There was a couple of places that the train... In fact, I think after getting to British Columbia, there was when the train did stop, there was a few boys got off of there. They never did find them because... Well, I guess there'd been a lot more got off there to know where they were going, but I know they never did find the boys they took off and they went... But this is, outside of that, it's just, you know, sort of a routine. It's the first time, actually, that I went this far on the train. But outside of that, like I said, we were getting to Vancouver and off that, onto the ship. And remember, this was an Australia or New Zealand ship that we were boarded on, and they served this beautiful supper that I suppose that you've heard, maybe some boys come out with it, and they, which here nobody eats mutton, you see, and this is what they were served, right? They figured that was a delicious meal for something we never eat, and God. Well, if you'd have seen, there was half of that boat off that gangplank before they realized that the boys are off the ship already. They had quite a time rounding them up. Oh, they had a whole crew and the cops trying to get them out back on there. So the first thing we knew, they got them back on, lifted the gangplank, and they just took the thing out about a mile out on the ocean and anchored it there for the night.
Did you go off the boat or did you stay on?
No, I didn't go off. I didn't. You know, those boys that were out a little more, they were more probably particular. If I was just concerned, after I was brought out here, like I said, my dad died, I was used to anything, you see, and this was a little different. And those boys, they wouldn't put up with this grub, you see, especially the boys that were in Jamaica. They knew what the food was like and all that. So when they got on this mutton setup, I wouldn't know no difference between mutton and them. So anyway, that was a little bit of experience first landing, first meal on that ship, you see. Apparently they changed it after they knew that we're not used to this kind of meals, and this is apparently in New Zealand, Australia, and this is their top dish or something.
What about the boat ride going over?
Well, the boat ride, well, you know, I took it very good, considering to a lot of boys that, you know, they took sick for days, and I never missed a meal. It just showed that, like I said, I was brought up on anything. Nothing could have hurt me.
Did you get more mutton on the way going over?
This is something I can't recall, you know. I know that the food was changed anyway. They knew that the boys are not going to put up with that. They're not going to eat that stuff, so I don't think that they tried that anymore.
Once you got on the boat, did you know that you were going to Hong Kong?
Or? No. In fact, we were in Hawaiian Island, and the only thing that they stopped us from doing is throwing cigarette packages overboard. Apparently, there were so many Japanese in Hawaii that they didn't want them. You know, there's all kinds of people walking around. They can pick up and know where we're from. They didn't want to know where these troops are coming from. Like we're all Canadian. We had Canadian packages there, so they made sure that we wouldn't throw any packages overboard or any wrappers that shows Canada, because they didn't want the Japanese to get to know that there's a bunch of troops are coming. But they didn't tell us where we're going either. We were in Philippine Islands. They didn't tell us where we're going. That's close to Hong Kong already. It only took us 2 days from there to go to Hong Kong. And after we left Philippine Islands, that's when they told us, because it was Hong Kong was the next stop. There was no more stoppage. That's when you couldn't get off the boat if you wanted to. So, well, Hong Kong is the next place. That's.
Did you do any training
on the boat? Oh, well, small drills, you know, PT and stuff like that after the boys got feeling a little better. Well, you have to do a little bit of exercising, otherwise the guys would be, you know, when they get monotonous. This week, keep them going for a little while. Keep your button shining up, one thing or another. But like I said, it took long enough. It was 3 weeks on that ship of that, from the time we left Vancouver to we arrived in Hong Kong.
I forgot to ask you which company you were in. Could you be assigned to?
C Company. Oh yeah, we all assigned to each company. We were, before you left here, you had a company, you see, because this is about all I can tell you on this trip of ours. Till we seen about a million Chinese waiting with this big rope to pull the ship into the. It's not, you know, no Chinese there, the only little fellas down there. My. It's scary with that clothes that they wear now. You know, it's different than Chinese over here down there, all that.
Yeah, it would be
satin black cloth that they wore, you know, and all barefooted. Just, you think that here they are, but that's their life down there. Yes, this is about as much as I can tell you on that trip.
They pulled the ship into the dock?
Well, they had to, you see. Well, they all do that, you see, because a ship comes in, and you think a great big thing like that comes in close. Well, they got these big ropes to tie them, you know, to them when they stopped, they to tie them against the dock. Yeah, and then it wasn't long till we were off that thing, you know.
You pack up your gear and march off the boat?
The gears, we had it with us. We all packed our gears and we marched. I believe the gears went on the trucks to the barracks. It was 3.5 mile route march to where the barracks were, you see, through the city. Kowloon City that we were on. And we marched without, well, it was far enough to march without anything, you know, for 3.5 miles marching with just off that ship after you've been for 3 weeks, you don't know actually marching whatsoever, but that's, it's course quite a little excitement too, you know, when you come into a city like that where you're never before, like China especially down there. There was no respect for the army, nothing. These coolies just run between the ranks or any place, you know. They're carrying these big buckets, buildings or anything, you know. They're all, all these fellas are carrying their stuff on their backs, you see. When they decided to go across that rank, they went. There was no stoppage because there's an army marching down here. But funny, but it's true as they put it there. Yeah, and then we finally landed up in this, like I said, on these barracks, which is a lot different than ours over here, you know. It's all cement floors and beds are all steel beds with these bug nets over them, which we had to have these bug nets because they're all type of bugs called mites, and so you have to have a net hanging down over the bed, you see. Because outside of that, I don't think that you'd be able to get a decent night's sleep with these bugs flying around. Well, that's something different too, you know. What else did I can tell you? Oh, yes. We got the little luxury. Well, in the morning, the Chinese used to come around and shave us, you know, and polish our buttons and everything else for about 10 cents, you see. Well, that was a little different than what we used to get here. Nobody would do that for 10 cents over here. Shave you and oh, do everything. Well, that didn't last very long because I think it was only, what, about 3 weeks. 3 weeks of that peacetime, but during the day we were taking our positions where we're in case of the war, where we're going to be fighting and all that up on these hills.
Where was that, on the mainland or on the island?
On the island, yeah, we had to go out mainland. We had nothing to do with the mainland, you see. We had to go up on the island and take positions, you see, and take our, like, some nights we had to stand guard duty overnight during these 3 weeks, and that's all it lasted, 3 weeks, because the day we landed there, but anyway, this war broke out. It was just, as far as I was concerned, everything sort of worked in 3 weeks from the time we left Vancouver, because we left Vancouver, it took 3 weeks to go across the ocean with the ship, and 3 weeks during the peacetime down looking around and how the city looks like. And then finally the war broke out, you see, and that lasted for 3 weeks too, you see. Everything seemed to be working in 3 weeks' time.
Had you been told that you might be at war with Japan?
Oh yes, but you know, you don't believe till you see it, you see. Oh yeah, the guys are the same as every place else. Everybody wants action before it starts, but when it starts then it's different stories. This is the same thing over there, because we had British troops down there and Indians down there. I think there was around 6,000 troops there altogether, besides us, but Indians and British. And what was I supposed to say? Well, naturally, when these planes did fly up, I remember like today we were outside and the boys said, "Now who's saying that we haven't got any planes? Look at them flying around." And all of these planes were, before we realized, here's great big bombs coming down. I said, "Oh God, this don't look like these planes are flying around." But you know, they flew around there, but it took an hour. Circled around before they come down there to the spot at where the barracks were, in the proper place before they start laying these little beautiful eggs down. But when they started coming down, that was a different story. Then everybody was in a rush and out of the places, because you know, when you start coming down, that's it.
Where were you when the
in Shamshipu barracks? You see, that's when that first attack came on, and then from then, actually, we were transported across to the island.
Was all of C Company on? At the barracks,
Well, I would think so. Well, unless the odd one was in the hospital, you know, because people in the hospital too. But could be a few in the hospital. But like I said, most of the boys were there, sure.
Were you ready? Had you trained well enough on the island?
Oh no! Oh, 3 weeks. What training did we have? We sort of spotted our positions where we'd be, just in case of war. We would go to defend. But as far as going fighting a Jap with a rifle, we have no more experience. And no. I mean, sure, we've shot a gun a few times, but that don't mean anything that you had a perfect training. Like Japanese, when they put their soldiers against us fighting, well, those guys were fighting for probably a few years before that, because as soon as they come out of those bushes, I've seen what they look like and how they look like when we're going fighting. Well, that's the difference there. No, but it still didn't mean anything. How good a fighter you were. That war wasn't fought with that, you know. It's strictly sea and air power. That's all you needed there. But like the Japs, they had the most of China then anyway, so what was for them? They had millions of troops to throw at us at that little island. So that was a great help to them.
Do you remember how long you functioned as a regiment? Or if you ever functioned as a regiment?
As a regiment.
Yeah, the Grenadiers.
Yeah, well, I think we, well, which way are you getting at? Before we went up in the hills fighting, or?
I'd say we
did function as a regiment all the way till we went up in the hills, because we used to parade up on the square all the time as a regiment.
Yeah, but after the war had started.
After the war stopped, well, naturally you were a prisoner.
Did you ever function as a regiment once the war started?
When the war started, it was pretty hard to function as a regiment because, you know, we were split up all over that island and I don't think anybody knew where anybody was. You know, this is the way it went. I was split up in a little platoon. There was only one little platoon in this little Aberdeen Island, which is another little channel there we went over.
Is that where you went to from Shamshipal?
In little Aberdeen, yeah. So we actually were Shamshipun and went on Hong Kong Island, and we were from Hong Kong, went on this little Aberdeen Island. Well, we were there for what? One day? One or two days? That's all. It was no use sitting there, because they were just bombing that thing to nothing, because there was nothing to defend there, only a little hill. So we were there a day or 2 days, and they brought us right to Hong Kong, to the island itself, because the guys... The Japs was pushing everybody around there already. See, they just come on there by millions.
What kind of equipment did you have? Did you have enough equipment? Or?
Well, what kind of weapon do you think a man can have? Is a rifle and an ammunition, as Rune went, a few things to eat, that's all. If you were lucky. But outside of that.
Did you have enough to eat or to drink?
Oh, no. We never. I never. There was one. I think there was about a week at the time you never seen food. You never got close to any place. Because whatever you had on you, there wasn't such a thing as these places here that that there's a wagon carrying food behind the front line or something. And there wasn't such a thing as that. If you were split up, you're set on that hill. If you had something to eat, fine. But there was not such a thing as a food car hauling you around. Because it's only hills there. And it just, the Japs were altogether different. Their setup might be, they were organized and they fought on those hills there for years before that. They get these coolies to carry water and rice behind them, which probably to get together and get this rice. And they live on a bit of rice maybe 2 days on this. And their equipment, I've seen their equipment and the amount of rice that they don't require eating like we do. So those guys brought up different. And we've seen when they're marching off the hills too, they have these big Chinese coolies, you see, that they've been captured, and they got them as for carrying these great big bottles of water and rice and stuff behind them all the time. Where the front moves around, that's where they are. But we never had anybody carrying food behind us. This is another thing. If you were a good scroungy, you probably got yourself something.
You
weren't.
You had to look for food.
Oh, yeah. I don't know where I got a hold of a loaf of bread and half a pound of butter, and we were... This battle was going on this evening, and we sort of held the boys there over the hill, the Japs. But as soon as it started getting daylight, we were moving out of there because, you could have heard them overnight that there was thousands of them over the hill, you see. But if they would ever come over, they would have had them all of us, because there was only a few of us on one side of the hill. But we made enough racket to keep them there, you see. Keep firing, and kept them there. But as soon as daylight broke, we went. And I remember like today that I had this loaf of bread and, you know, just under a little tree there and some butter, and we were way down the hill already. And when I thought of it, well, this is the only thing I had to eat. the next day or the day after. I didn't know when I'd get my next bit of eat. So I went back for this, some bread and butter that I had. And by that time, I lost all the rest of the boys that went down, you see. Well, I believe the sniper could have picked me off any place then, just taking that chance, you see. But I went down and I lost them, and I come down the little village, and I never seen one soul. This was my bit of experience. Not one soul, not a soldier to be seen. Only a few dead ones down on the streets and stuff like that. So I walked through there just, you know, as brave as nothing that because of God, anybody could pick you off there. And I run and I ran into a roadblock where our own roadblock, like the Indians from India, they were had this roadblock there. And of course, like us Canadians, we had these big coveralls and big Canada on the side here. Well, I couldn't talk Indian, neither they can talk Canadian English, right? So anyway, they seen where I come from. So I knew I was safe there when I was beside them. So I said, oh, I was played out. You know, no sleep or nothing for days. So I sort of went around, sat down there, and that's the piece of bread I had and that butter, and I sat down there and I ate and I had a little bit of water with they had. You can see them today. I guess the guys, Indian, they were there, used to living in the places like that, and they had this. This is the first time that I ever seen too. They had this great big peace pipe, what they call them. I can see them turning this, and they're all having a puff out of it, you know, right on this roadblock down there. Then after a little rest, I walked. This was just getting the end of the war, you see. I walked all the way around the south end. And I figured if I can get into where the English roadblock is, you'd find out what the setup is. But I knew we were getting pushed right out of the island already. So when I got down to the English roadblock, which was close to the hospital already.
I have a map here.
Bone-on Hospital. Well, you know, the things have changed now, but at that time, have you got a map here of the old setup during the war? Is that a fact? Well, like I said, I came down there and it's...
That's the official map.
Is that the old map during the war?
Well, I don't know if that was the one that you had seen or were issued with. Probably not.
Oh, I have no map. We never had a map. We were never issued with a map. Just
here's the island, anyway. It shows some of the hills.
This is the island here, eh? This is, which would be the north side of
this
the island?
This would be the north. Here's Kowloon and Shemshiko Camp. Here's this view.
Kowloon. That's the north here.
Yeah.
Oh.
And the Japanese came across here.
Yeah, yeah, they come right across here. This is where they landed, you see.
Stanley.
And this is where
Stanley
we were.
And Aberdeen. I guess this is Aberdeen Island here.
Well, that could be. See, there's a little Aberdeen right here. Yeah, yep. Little Aberdeen, yeah. That's where it is.
I have a bigger map.
Yeah, little Aberdeen. There's a little Hong Kong. Just a minute, I'll find up.
Yep.
We should have Bone Road Hospital over here someplace.
I don't know if it's marked on there or not.
Maybe not.
I don't think so.
But anyway, this is...
Here's Happy Valley, if that helps.
Happy Valley.
One Nishon Gap.
Oh, yeah, one Chun Gap, yeah. One Chun Gap. This is the gap that we were...
There's a reservoir in there.
This was the terrible place where all the bit, most of the boys got killed up over here, up this gap, you see. Because this was the sort of an opening. And anybody going through here, they spotted you, and this where the artillery used to go up and out here. Oh, this was a terrible thing.
So you had gone from Shamshapo to the island, then over to Aberdeen somewhere.
Well, this is how we went, you see. We actually from Shamshapo we went to Hong Kong and then over to the little island over here.
Mm-hmm.
This the little Aberdeen Island. Yeah, yeah. This is the Aberdeen.
The
yeah, you got the name right there. This is the little island that we were defending. We were there very long. You can just imagine this. It's just about three big hills, one there and one there and one there. You see, that's all you can see, and then the rest of it is Chinese, just millions down the bottom, right around that island. You see,
mm-hmm.
Especially around this part here. You see, along the coast of the between the Aberdeen and the Hong Kong. Yeah, well, this is I just pointed out. You see, yeah, right here. You see, we were. This is one shy gap. You see, like that. We were so close to Aberdeen. We're up here. fighting over here when I come down at night. You see, over here someplace I wouldn't see because it was very close to the Aberdeen, mm-hmm. little Aberdeen town here, see. So they came down here and the roadblock was about there, see. Mm-hmm. You'd see, about there. Then from there, I walked all the way down to here. Because there was roads cut across here, I believe.
Victoria Peak in here.
Victoria, this is the peak, yeah. Well, anyway, that hostel could have been on this run here, you see.
Bone
Road Hostel. So anyway, I walked. There was a guard between the hospital, not too far from the hospital anyway, where the British had their roadblock. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I went right by there and I went to the hospital. By the hospital, and somebody came out there and he said, and I had this rifle with me and everything else. Well, he said, if you're coming into the rifle, you better take it over to the guardhouse, take the rifle down there if you have to come to the hospital. But he didn't know what I was coming. So I said, no, I don't want to go to the hospital. I'm just coming out for a rest. I hadn't never slept for days. So sure enough, I came down, went back, and the boys, the British boys were there, so I just lay down on a bench there, went to sleep till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd say. And then all of a sudden, I didn't hear a voice saying, "That's." And we marched down to the barracks where the British were stationed before, and this is where we stayed for a day and a half before the Japs came around. During that time, we had enough time to loot a little bit. Like the barber, I had all the barber equipment, my scissors and clippers and what have you, see. Scrounged the flume blankets. What else did I was pretty well off. I was pretty well prepared for being a prisoner already because I had blankets, I had things, you know, because everything was in the bags and shaving stuff. So when the Japs did come around, We already packed with this stuff here, and they marched us out. And the first thing we knew, they took us to North Point to start with. It's down here someplace, too.
Did they round many of you up at the same time?
Well, apparently they were bringing them, every day, you know. But there was, I'd say, must have been about 800 of us at that time, you see, because we were putting the biggest collection around that thing there when they took us to North Point. And then after that, they were bringing them in, even a few, how did it work? No, we went to Sham Shapur, and then come back to North Point. We stayed at North Point for a long time. You know, I think that they took us to Sham Shapur bags, that's to the mainland. To start with, they put us on these barges, just flat barges, and they took us across to Sham Shapur. They didn't keep us too long there because they brought us back to North Point and they sort of split Canadians, see, Canadians only, to North Point, and they left the British and the Indians at Sham Shapur. And this is how we happened to be at North Point, and we stayed there for, at least 8 months, I believe, till the boys really start, dying off, and then they moved us to Sham Shapur. Yeah, and was it the one with I was going to give you a little history on that little experience.
Is there something about the battle? Remember, if there's any men that sort of stand out in your mind, were you wounded at all, or did you have any friends?
I wasn't wounded, but I had a friend of mine, one of the best friend of mine, it just happened that don't know how we were behind. We never got on front line with the others, but we were a day late. Like, our boys went up on the hills one day, and I got left with this friend of mine till the next day when we got down to this pillbox where we were splitting up to go to your own platoons, you see. This other kid, he was in D Company, I was in C Company. And I knew that Aberdeen Island is my position. And this kid had to go up on the hills, you see, in Hong Kong. And a day later, when they took us from Little Aberdeen and brought us down to this pillbox, and he was in this D Company, and right away they put us on this hill where this big fighting was going on. the first news that I got that friend of mine that I split up, he was dead the next morning, you see. This is the worst, saddest news that I got, you know, so sudden that you split up with you, and then the next thing you know, he's gone. So this is sort of hard on anybody to hear news like that, you know, especially that's the last guy that you've seen and then he's gone. But nevertheless, like I said, and then another good friend of mine over here, which, oh, there were so many different guys that getting, you know, alongside of you, getting wounded. Harding, he's you've met him probably, Harding. And he had a machine gun, you see, and he was right alongside of me. And I was supposed to be supplying him with ammunition, you see, and he was operating the machine gun, which I was a little bit behind him. And he just lifted enough, you know, to crawl up a bit. Well, at the meantime, the Japs open up with a machine gun, and you know how the machine gun slices everything down. Well, he just lifted enough to get a bullet, right past his head into the, how would you call it, blade, shoulder blade. So there's two of them come right out of his back here and never touched the bone. All you could hear is the guy groan and lay down. That's all there was to it. But that's how close you can get. But that's about as close as I've seen that the man getting put his right there, you see. He was the closest to me.
Were you two alone, or were there other people?
Oh, no, there's people on the side, but, well, I was right beside him because I was feeding the machine gun with the ammunition. See, this is what how close it came in. And other, like, there was
what happened then? Did he go to the...
Oh yeah, they right away. You don't move until as long as the action is going from the other side, because you'll just get it. That's all that you can't. You're there and you just call. You just put your head as low on the ground as you can. But as soon as they slow down, you see, then we open up with guns, and then that time that you've got a chance to move, you see, because you either one side is going to shell or the other side, dude, and everybody can't shell at the same time because somebody's got to put their heads away. So that's when you go down. Of course, that's all down there. It's all mountains anyway. So you just somebody come down and get you out of the road, you see. So this was the end of his action there for a while, I guess. And close like that, that the guys. Well, there was all kinds of getting wounded, but I mean, I wasn't right beside the fellow. But you know, action is action. You're not going to crawl around because you're going to get at the same thing. You can't move when there's action going on.
But what did you think of the officers that you were serving under, especially during the battle?
Well, the officer that we had was Bailey. He was our company commander, and we never did see him. He was in a pillbox. He was too scared to go with it. He was the only one. I don't know. He come in here. I don't know what the boys thought of him, but he was that type. He'd chase everybody else out of the pillbox to get out in front, but he wouldn't go out there himself like a man, you see. We had good sergeants, so they stayed right out with us, but like a company commander, he's supposed to be with the rest of the boys too, but he stayed close to the, to like the boys said, to the rum and the pillbox. But that was about the size of it, yeah. Some of the officers were real good, the boys that, you know, different companies had them, and they were real men. And to outside of that, what can I tell you yet? Front battling, outside of, like I said, I think it was about the first week that we were on front lines, that's the first bit of food that I've seen come up there. We sort of reinforced a D company, our C company come up, and they brought this food, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's the first time that I've seen how they were going to bring out to feed them, to feed their company. So they set up these buckets, you see. Of course, you know, there's always watchmen from the enemy spotting there with field glasses all around. They didn't see what's going on. And actually, where all the pots were, where the boys start collecting a wee bit, the first thing you know, a great big trench mortar start hitting right on the spot. All we've seen is the pots fly in every direction. This was the end of our food there. I never seen a bit of them. Well, who was hanging around them? Oh, then, you see, this is the thing that happens. You don't get a chance to eat. So from then on, I don't think that once in a while we, some dry food come out there, like hardtacks and some dry, some canned sausage or something like that. And you know, when you're thirsty, you want a drink, and there wasn't a water if you cried anyplace. because we knew that this water that was running off these hills weren't safe to drink, because there was such a diseased water all over that wasn't even funny. So,
how did you feel about the surrender?
Well, I'll tell you, I was so beat, you know. You didn't have to be long on that, actually, but I mean, if you didn't sleep all that time and didn't eat, I was beat. I was beat. I wasn't worrying whether the action was over or not. I was sort of glad that the thing was over. Well, I figured, well, from now on, we're going to start again. I don't know what's going to happen, but this was the thing. We just, well, I don't know how some boys were. The boys probably that lived a little better, and they might have felt different, but if you were up on the hills all that time, you know, you had enough. That's all I could take, you know. Because I know when I come up to those guards there, the roadblock there, when I dropped it, even the bomb could have fallen on top of you. You didn't care, you see. And what else did we go?
How about the camp? You mentioned that you went to Sham Shapoo. Give me a little bit about the barracks, what they were like, and the food.
Oh, yeah. Well,
if there was any organization,
there was the barracks that we went to. You see, those barracks, they had no windows or no doors. You see, and all these wooden beds, all wooden. There wasn't a thing. We had nobody gave us anything. This was the first year nobody gave us anything. Whatever we scrounged from the hills, this is what you had. If you had any clothes on you, that's all you had. If you had a blanket with you, you were fine. Another guy had no blanket. This is the way we lived. That's no way out.
Did you have any money? You mentioned you had some blankets and some barbed wire.
I had this stuff here, the barber equipment, the blankets. This is what I've used sleeping on. The barber equipment, I got so in a whole camp that there was nobody had a barber set or shaved. I was the only man that had that, and I got to be such a big barber there towards the end, it wasn't even funny. I wish I'd have had the book here. I'd have put that on the museum. All the boys signed their names, and every time I cut hair or I shaved them, they initialed, you see. So I figured when I get back to Canada, I was going to be a rich man here. By the time everybody pays me off. But, you know, out of the whole deal, I think that there was about 400 or 500 died before we ever got any place, that I've had them struck up the names already. But anyway, this was kept my hopes going all the time, because I was busy every day cutting hairs and shaves. Didn't matter if it was an officer or who it was. They all had to get their haircuts. But that's, like I said, that's somebody had to be lucky enough to scrounge a thing like that. Otherwise, there wasn't a...
Did you just sort of happen into it because you were the one with the equipment?
Because I was the one with the equipment, you see. And I had a little experience. I used to cut here before I left, you know, trained out of myself. Just didn't have to go to school as far as the haircut is concerned. I did quite a bit of haircutting when I was up on the relief camp at Clear Lake here. And this is what got me started. And when I was over there, sure, I had a little experience how to cut hair and shave. So from then on, I there was no reason why you couldn't get any more, because they were standing on line all the time. So...
Did you ever get paid at all, or was just marked down?
Oh, this was, you see, kept, you know, it's just that, which way would you put this setup? You would say, keep your morale, keep yourself happy. Is that the way you're getting?
Sure.
At least keep yourself happy. You're thinking you're making money every day, you see. And this is what sort of keeps you going too, you know. You, instead of looking on the bad side of it, you're always looking to the good side of the whole thing, regardless of what type of a life you're having down there. But you figure, well, someday if you get out, you're going to click in a few dollars, you see. Which naturally, when the war did end, I wouldn't even dare ask. I was glad to get out of there myself. Never mind asking the guys for money. I'm glad to see them coming out of there. Oh, I don't think that the intention right to start, but yes, the intention was good. Like you'd say, yeah, by God, I'll get out of there, and the boys would pay. And
did you have a little place, a stool or anything that you? Or
we built ourselves a chair down here out of a few boards, yeah, hammered together. It's a sort of a kneeling chair, you know. It front folds it back, and it stayed that in one position all the time. It wasn't one of these chairs you can lift them or anything, but it's a chair anyway, a barber's chair. It was easier that way to shave them, because as far as cutting hair, you can sit them up, but shaving, see, as long as you can have a little kneel. So just build it out of boards, and that was our barber set there.
Was it inside a... outside or?
No, no, I had it inside. We always cut it inside, you know, because it got so, this war ended in November, don't forget, and in the wintertime, you don't get snow, but it gets chilly and wet, you know, and naturally. And the boys weren't in too bad of, in the best of health, I'll tell you that, because after a few months of that beating there with no food and no medicine, they were going down by the day, you know. What was I going to say? A friend of mine, even this fellow that you're going to introduce, Mike Kachan, you know, I can give you a little history of him. I just wondered what he can tell you about me, but I'll tell him. I'll tell you a little bit about him. See, you don't know people till you, like you say, you don't know people till you sleep with them. Now, I slept on the top bunk side by side, like there was two bunks together, like. And that's in Shamshapu, North Point, yeah. And I had $100 in my pocket, Canadian money yet, you know. We had a few cigarettes previous to that time, and I supplied him with cigarettes before, and he had some. And when this was finished, I said, Mike, I've got $100 in my pocket yet. And I knew these Japanese guards, the army guards, they were black marketing cigarettes, you see. You could buy it off of them. But they were charging us $1 a cigarette, $1 for a Canadian cigarette. So I had $100, so $100 was no good to me anymore, because just another piece of paper. So the only thing I could invest, I said, well, I can buy 100 cigarettes. This is what I did. Bought 100 cigarettes. And this Mike, you know, you couldn't smoke yourself and see him laying there. So I shared with him. But I got I think it lasted us 2 weeks, those 100 cigarettes. You know, we stretched it out. And we collected. It's not like here, you know, you throw butts away. Down there we had a box and we butted every butt, put it in its box. After 2 weeks, the cigarettes were gone. And so I looked at these, and of course, they all belong to me. It's all $100 invested in that. So when I looked at those butts, and I knew there was no way of getting any more cigarettes, so I frankly said to Mike, I said, are you going to keep smoking or are you going to quit? Oh, he said, I'll quit eating, but I've got to smoke, you see. So I said, okay, you can keep smoking, but I'm going to eat. So what I did, I said, here's the box of butts, Mike. You smoke. I just made up my mind right there and then, and I quit. I just quit there, you know. And he kept smoking, but, you know, you just teasing yourself after that. And it got to the point where the guys were just smoking and there was hardly nothing to eat. And it got so that there was always some guy, his stomach is gone or something. Well, I'd say just like an alcoholic, he has to have a cigarette, you see. He has to have a cigarette, so he gets this little bit of ration of rice to eat for his meal. That's all you'd get, one ration a day, you see. And this poor guy would be walking all over the barracks trying to get ready to pound it off for a cigarette, you see. So after I did scrounge a cigarette here or there, this is what kept me going. I'd always buy an extra bit of rice, you see. The officers used to sell them, you know. They used to get more than we did. They'd get a buck and then they split between themselves. So they always get a little rice left over. Well, they'll be pounding them off too. They knew who had cigarettes. Well, this is the way I used to keep me going, you see. And him, he kept on smoking, which was impossible regardless where you go. This I'm talking about Shamshapu, North Point first. And before I knew it, no, Mike was still all right in Shamshapu, or North Point. And then we got transferred over, after about, I think we weren't there any more than about 4 months in North Point. And at that time, when we first got captured there, you see, we had some flour and stuff, and our boys were still making buns and stuff like that. You know, I did tell you that one experience there that while we were still making our buns and stuff, the guards were only guarding around the barracks. There was nobody to look after our kitchen because they never brought anything in there. We had our own bread, and they brought us some bread from flour and stuff like that to bake buns, and that's about all we had, and then some weeds to make soups. And apparently some of our boys made an arrangement that they were going to escape, you see. One fellow from Mangusville, there was another sergeant, there was three of them that went over the building this particular night. And we spent the next morning, when the Japs discovered that we got three missing, we stood there for 24 hours out in the rain and no food till somebody had to spit out where the boys went, and they finally told them that they went over. Of course, we heard later that they didn't last very long, because they shot them off about 3 weeks after the escape, you see. So there was no reason you'd take your chance living there, or escaping didn't help anything. But, of course, we suffered a little bit over it, too, but, you know. So, anyway, that's when this sickness took us. After 4 months, I think after 4 months, with this, nothing to eat, you know. It was just getting to be less and less and less. And the boys were going down. I believe we weren't even getting rice at North Point. We're just getting this bun a day or some water. But you know how long you can live on that. Can't live forever. But the boys were getting sicker, you see. It's North Point that I took a fever there. And it held me for, I'd say, about 35 days straight. No relief. And a friend of mine, Macaulay, I'm here from Macaulay, Manitoba, he was 21 years of age and he weighed 220 pounds, you know. And then that fever kept him for 3 months, never come out. And he used to walk outside, you know, because there was nobody looking after you. You had to go to the can or stuff like that. You had to make it on your own. And you could see him, and you'd see a lot of drunk fellas and drinking, staggering. That's the way the boys were over there, just staggering from bed to bed and getting out, or even walking on the square, or the same thing. But that kid, he from 220, in 3 months, he weighed 95 pounds. How would you like that, too? For losing the weight. But he wasn't, he was just going down. He couldn't eat, you see. He took sick. And all the medicine that we had is twice a day, a half an aspirin. This is, you couldn't even get a whole aspirin. Half an aspirin, so we rationed out so bad. Well, you know, you couldn't blame anybody. Our doctors had nothing. Nobody else had anything.
Where did you get the aspirin from?
Well, apparently this was what was left, what we were captured. This is what the doctors had with them, and this
did
is what kept.
Did you go to the doctor and ask for it, or was they just?
Oh, yes. Well, naturally, when you're sick, you go to the doctor, but, you know, you go on this sick parade, but what can they give you, you know? Sure, they say, well, this is what we got, and here it is, and you know. And every day you go there and take your temperature, and you're hoping for the best. This is all it was, is living on hope. There was no getting cured from nothing. You're just living on hope. Like I said, even this Macaulay, he pulled through and he come out of it. And then the dysentery and diphtheria, everything started going on. People don't realize how many sickness that you've got. And they figured, well, even the Japs down there, they didn't mark them off that they starved to death. They marked them off that they died of the natural causes, you see. And what caused the natural causes? The starvation, because when you ran down so low, no resistance of fighting anything. It was something that has to kill you. Yeah, and then after we got moved from North Point to Shamshipu, this was the hardship then, you know. They brought rice, but it was cooked so watery that they gave us this rice once a day, about a cupful. You could pour it out of the cup, that's how thin that stuff was. And then we'd stand in line for hours at the time waiting for warm water. At noon, this is what we get at noon. Warm water, not hot water. This was your rations. To drink, that's about the size of it. And that only lasted for the whole thing, I think, about 8 months, till the boys were really starting to go. You know, you could see them every day. There'd be 10 dead, you know. They'd pick out about 6-7 of our boys to dig a hole and bury them. But like I said, that's about the size. You could see them boys walking around. They weren't walking on their own. They were just staggering around.
Was there any kind of a burial detail or a ceremony for guys?
Oh, no. They just wrapped them in a blanket that you laid on. They just wrap you up and throw them on the back of the truck, this is the way they load them. There was not such a thing as bringing a box in and put them in there. Not in Shamshipu. Not in Shamshipu during the time that I was there, that year. And then, like I said, the same thing with the conditions there. Nothing. There wasn't a blanket. They never gave us a thing on a steel bed with a cement floor and cement walls. The Chinese, when they moved us there, the Chinese looted all the windows out and all the doors. You just sitting down there just hoping that the thing is...
Did you ever get an opportunity to get some food and cook it yourself?
Oh, no. Where would you get that? There wasn't that thing. Some guys, scrounged, I never seen it. But there was a snake or something crawl around like that. It didn't last too long because they got a hold of them. But in our parties, especially being in Hong Kong, there wasn't anything that you could get a hold of because we went... After a bit, we went to work, which we were building a airport there, putting the hills down. This was all hand power. There was no machines working there. It was all prisoners pulling these mountains down to build an airport for the Japanese. And like I said, even then, you couldn't scrounge a thing because you were watched so close all over, you'd darn do nothing because they'd shoot you right there.
Were you working with picks and shovels? Or
picks and shovels and these push cars with little tracks pushing the hills down. This was all down by hand where you're just barely moving around, but you had to be there, and that's all there was to it. They weren't worrying whether you dropped dead the next day or nothing. This is the way it went. And that's what the guy that was killing the guys worse than ever. We were just barely existing, and they made us work it. You see, and this was us killing them faster than anything.
I'm really interested. You were the only man that was coming here, or one of the very few. Where did you get soap and razor blades?
Soap and razor blades. This was I had the barber's razor, one of these that you strap them on?
Yeah.
The straight one. This is the thing, Kato. Oh, you don't know such thing as a blade. It's a straight razor. Otherwise, you'd have never had it. I had that all the way through. I brought it home, and I wish I would have had it. I'd have put that thing in the museum, and I asked the wife, I said, what happened to that razor? The setup that I had over there, I had it here. I brought the belt to one of these great big white belts that I had it on me, and with a buckle and anything, and I even cut it a few places that I was strapping the thing with. But that's the thing, quite a history on that belt there and that razor. That thing is still around. If I ever find it, I'll bring it over there. But I'd sure like to have that. That was little history behind that razor and that blade and those clippers. Soap, we never, we had enough soap with us that we scrounged or something because, to make enough lather, it didn't take one bar of soap probably last me for a year, maybe more, you see, for as far as lathering is concerned. That wasn't, that's the only thing that, it wasn't too much. We weren't using soap or anything else because there was no soap to be washed with.
Were the men getting their hair cut short along the line?
Oh, no. Everybody was cutting their hair. Well, we were cutting our hair especially like here, but when the Japs got a hold of us after, in a prison camp in Shamshipu, they weren't doing anything there. But like I say, after we went to Japan, we were clipped like the Japs, you see, right down to nothing. Their soldiers are clipped that way, and that's the way we were, every one of us. In fact, I was, how many Japanese guards I clipped their hairs and shaved them? That was quite a little experience. You were always tempting to cut his throat, see. And the way they shave their eyebrows, their nose, and their ears inside. They grow hair all over. They don't grow too much whiskers, You grow a few fuzzes on there. But, it's always tempting. But, I used to make good every time I shaved a guard because... And cut his hair, it gave me 10 cigarettes, you see. And this was extra food for me. This is what was bringing me up a little bit, kept me living here. And it's a funny that they used to, I always thought that they'd take a chance, you're slicing his throat over here with that razor. But I guess you can kill one, but you can't kill them all. So That's the only thing you had to kill is that one. But you had a chance to do one.
would you do barbering every day?
Oh, yeah. Unless I wasn't feeling good, but every day that I was feeling good, I was, oh, yeah. Well, don't forget that there was a lot of men there. How many can you do a day?
You would get to know an awful lot of the men.
Oh, I had the name. You might have brought that book and whatever happened. I wish I had put that in a museum, all that great big book with the guys who are putting their names on and everything. I bet you it's at Frank's yet, if I could ever get it. If I could get a hold of that book, I'll bring that book along too.
Did the men want their hair cut in a certain way, or really kind of interesting?
No, well, I'll tell you, just to get it cut, you see, because nobody wore long hair. Well, now the boys do, but at that time, you know, it was an army style haircut is, you know, being neat, and nobody wore any hair at all. It's just, but you know, the less hair you had, the less caring taking you had to do, because you know there was no soap or nothing to clean yourself up. You just live, boy, the way you, the least hair you had, the better it was for you. And this is the way you. There wasn't such a thing that you had hot water or stuff like that to wash with. Like I said, even your clothes. I believe that. That clothes that I had with me when I was captured, I wore that, the whole year, and I was moved to Japan with that same clothes on. This is about, and you only had about a shirt, maybe another one, that's all. Yeah. You had to keep this going, and you had to go to work with this on. Patch it up, and whatever you had, and try and keep it as clean as you can, because nobody else will keep it clean for you.
In the barber kit, what kind of things did you have? You had a pair of scissors?
Oh, I had all the barber's tool. I had the scissors. In fact, I might have had a couple of scissors. And I had two razors, two straight razors. And I believe I had a couple of pairs of clippers, these hand clippers. And I had the brush. Well, I went into the army barber shop. And, you know, it's left there, and you help yourself. Well, I knew I could make use of it. You know, right at that time, at least, I figured I'd make use of it for a little while, cutting my hair, somebody cut my hair. But if I'd have known I was going into the barber's business like that, I'd have probably got a lot more stuff. But this is the thing, is, you know, it's a good thing that somebody got a hold of something. Otherwise, there'd be nothing there. I've seen guys sharpening a knife and trying to shave with it, you know. And this is a...
Did you have a towel or anything to put over the shoulders?
Well, I had something to put over the shoulders, you know, to cut the hair. Yeah, and a lot of boys.
I'm really interested. That's one of
That's a proper thing. Yeah. I believe it is. Yeah. Well, you know what kind of a clot you'd have? You'd have that one clot there, and I'd probably use it all the time as a prisoner of war. That's to shake it off, and another fella comes on. Oh, yes, that's one of the greatest. Like I said, it kept the other fellows going, because they were all good to me, too, because everybody had to have a haircut or a shave, you see.
Did the officers come to you also?
Oh, yes. Well, there's nobody else who's cutting, you see. Didn't matter whether you're an officer, who you were. You can't go to the barber. There's no barber in the place. A prison camp is a prison camp, you know. There isn't such a thing as anything. You just, like the officer come up, he said, there isn't such a thing as an officer or a private. We're all private. You look after yourself. Mm-hmm. We're not telling you what to do. And this is exactly the truth it is. As long as you were a good provider for keep yourself up, this is the thing that meant the whole thing to you in the prison camp.
Did you have anything for the men to read when they were getting haircut, or did you just sort of sit and talk?
Oh, well, read. I there wasn't such a thing as a reading material in the prison camp. Where would you get it? There's nothing there, you see. Definitely not. They're laying down anyway, whether they're cutting their hair or they're laying down in their bunk. Or sitting outside and out in the sun, you see. That didn't matter anyway, because you weren't doing anything. You know, during the time that we were in North Point, in Shamshipu, the fellows that were, you know, were able to go to work, they took them out. But the fellow that was wounded, without a hand or crippled, now naturally he can't work, so he was left behind. But like I said, the people that were able to go to work, they went to work. Yes, that was in Shamshipu. Well, of course, that took me from about a year. We were captured in December, and the following January we were moved to Japan, you see. Like that group, the fellows that I went, I think I was in about a second group that was going to Japan.
Were you picked to go?
Yes, you're named, everyone that's going, you just come up there, your name, they're all, there isn't such a thing, you said, no, I'm not going. The fellows that were left behind, as such guy like Kachan here, I was trying to tell you what smoking did to him, you see. I was started there, and give him these butts, and I said that kept me living a little better. And after we moved to Shamshipu, he got so that you've heard of this dry beriberi. The fellas were crippling up on their legs. The feet started burning. They used to burn like that stove. There wasn't a place that you could cool them off, you know. And they started drying out on you and burning. Well, people figure that they've got a toothache here. Their feet used to be worse than a toothache. There wasn't a place to put them. They used to put them in a great big buckets. There they got them from some place and fill them up with ice cold water, and that's the only. And then they lean over their bunk, and the only bit of sleep that they'd get is having this. And then that water would get warm from those feet. They'd have to change it. And this is one particular guy, this Mike here, that smoke killed him like that, see? He sold too much of his food that, you know, he couldn't afford to do that. But he figured he'd smoke. So the first thing I knew, he was up at night walking on a cement, start crying, and crying like a baby, you know. Well, you know, there's nobody to cry to, but he started talking to himself and walking up and down on the cement, cooling his feet, you know, at night, because it's the only time that cement cool up. And he's all crying what the mother and grandma used to tell him when he joined the army, this is what's going to happen. And there he is. He had everything pictured right in front of him, walking around on the cement. So I once in a while I come up and I rave him over that a little bit now. You know, it's nice over here to rave each other, but it wasn't very jokey over there. But you have to make fun there too, you know. You can't just sit down and die. You just, you know, you just make poking fun one of each other.
What was it like going to Japan, the boat that you went on?
When we were going on this boat, you see, when they put us, it's a great big boat. Apparently they were transporting everything on it, and they got us. I don't know. I've heard how they packed pigs in a one little bins, you see, and that's how they got us in there. There wasn't a room to sit down. They packed us so tight where we're just like sardines standing in these particular rooms where they put us in there. And we were on that thing for, must have been pretty near 3 days, I think, from the time we left. Either 2 days and two nights, something like that. And all those 2 days and two nights are standing up. There was a room to sit down. Till we got into Nagasaki, I guess the south point of Japan, when they unloaded us. That was only the start there. That's the first piece of bread I think we got for that year. They gave us this lunch down there when we got off. This is part of our supper or something. They brought these buns over there and drink of water. And then they put us on the trains, and from there we went all the way to Tokyo. We were stationed between Tokyo and Yokohama, which was to call the 3D shipyards, you see. There's brand new prison camps built up over there for us. During a few days there, it wasn't sort of, they fed us not too bad, you know. That's the first bit of, you know, have decent food. I think that's what kept us living from then on, you know. We went to work every day, but they give us half-decent rice and, you know, half-decent soups. We don't call that soups over here, but we figured that was real decent soups to what we had before that.
Yeah, were they cooking it for you?
Oh, the Japs were cooking it for us. They were right there cooking us for us. Later on, they put our own cooks on there, but they were in charge of our cooks. They told them what to cook, too. But our cooks were cooking it later on. But the first couple of weeks, the Japs were doing all the cooking, you see. And like I said, the first, I think, couple of days, we were getting sort of organized in the camps. And then they walked us over to where we were going to work.
And that was
a march of 2.5 miles, you see, every day to work and back, walk. And this was working on these shipyards. And my first job was working on the side of the ship with a big reamer. And I don't know, I never had such experience in my life. To crawl up on the ladder about 75 feet alongside the ship and nothing to hang on, and here's the two pieces of board to stand on and get a hold of a 50-pound reamer and two for the two boys and start reaming that. Well, if the first couple of days it was about the worst of it, because well, you look down there and it sure scared you to death. But there was no way out. You couldn't crawl out of there. You just got to do it. You're a prisoner. And then you go there and you do it. The jet goes up with you. It was all right for them. They're used to that height, you see, and everything. But God, we come out from like, we were shaky as it was, without with no power or nothing. But anyway, we started off with that and kept going. I worked on that reamer there for quite a while till I got beaten up by a Jap, you know, our own Jap. We were carrying this great big steel plates, you see, certain places for the ship, you see. And it just happened, there was about 4 of us coming. And when he come up to this plate, well, naturally, they're talking Japanese. I didn't understand him no more. But regardless, he pointed on this great big plate to lift, take it back to the ship. Well, there was 5 of us, you see, we're walking one behind the other. I happened to be right behind. Well, I turned around, I was telling the boys, well, let's lift it up and carry, you know, more than one, because it's too big for one. Well, he figured that I meant another fellow to carry it, and he just turned around and grabbed the bolt and just knocked me over the head. Cracked my skull right in the back here. So I was bleeding. Well, naturally, the other boys seen what he was doing. Well, they just get a hold of that big piece of metal and went with it. Well, right away, I went back, and the guide come around and marched me up to the mess already, because my head is bleeding all over. That's when I got away from that heavy work. I stayed in camp for about a week after. And they put me on a cleaning gang with the rest of them, which were cleaning the ships, you know, all the bolts and ashes and everything else, the bottom of the ships and all over sweeping, which was a little easier job. I believe I stayed with them for a year like that. Then I was on a buggy wagon, which moving the acetylene bottles. We carried that all over the shipyards, and there'd be about 6 of us, you see. 3 boys pulling it and one fellow hanging on to the back. That was quite just like a horse, I'm telling you. It's pulling that thing around, distributing bottles, acetylene bottles all over. And
what kind of a schedule were you working? Were you working every day?
There isn't a schedule there. You see, in Canada we have a schedule. At least we're looking forward to a Sunday. And down there wasn't such a thing as a Sunday unless some big Japanese birthday or a death or something. That's the only thing. And some months it used to come in once a month. Some months it never come in that way. So you just go every day. There's no such a thing as you work 6 days a week and 7 days you rest.
So there would be some kind of a routine that you would get into. You would get up sometime in the morning early, like.
Oh, well, it's not a routine. The Japs, they come through just like the army. You're woke up at I think we were up at 6 o'clock or 6:30 in the morning, and at 8 o'clock we were marching to work already. 8 o'clock we had to leave the camp. Every day there wasn't a day unless you were sick. There wasn't such excuse that you'd say, I can't go to work.
What kind of thing would happen from when you, time you woke up in the morning till you were on your way to work?
Well, like I say, I think they got us up about 6:30, so We left for work. We're already on parade and left for work at 8 o'clock.
Did you have anything to eat?
Oh, yes. Well, this is the time they wake you up, and then you go and wash and, you know, clean up as much as you can with what you had, because even in winter time there was no hot water, no nothing. Sometimes those taps are even frozen. So you'd clean up, and then they serve you this breakfast, which is continues the same thing over and over again.
Did they bring it around to you, or did you go to get it?
Well, we were, like I said, after a bit, our own boys were in charge of it. So every section, we were split up into sections down there. So every section had a bucket of rice, hey?
A bowl?
A bucket of rice. A bucket.
Like a pail.
A big pail of rice, you see. So anyway, every day a different man is picked out to go and get that pail, you see. So if it's my turn comes in, next day is yours, and so on and so forth, you see. So I'll go and get that rice, and we appointed three guys, different fellows every day, to dish it out, you see. Like you'd have a bucket of soup and a bucket of rice. Okay, you got your own bowl, so you come around. All we got is a measuring cup, you see. Everybody gets the same thing. There isn't such a thing that you get more and there's less. It's a measuring cup, and we put that measuring cup into your bowl, and away you go. You don't wait for any more because you're not getting any more. This is the way it goes, you see. And every day, everybody had their chores. Everybody had to dish out, different fellows dished out different days, you see. So this is the way it worked. And everything is, like I said, it's all rationed out, and it's, if we got the bucket, we know exactly how much rice there is in that bucket because we dish it out every day. So we know how many men we got. So we know what kind of measure we need to make sure that it lasts out for everybody.
Did the food ever change very much day to day or week to week?
Well, it's changed. It changed from worse to worse. I'll tell you, that's how it changed. We used, from the start, we got half decent barley. We have decent rice. Then we got this Korean rice, what they call a red. It's red rice or whatever they call it anyway. Then they changed it from that. They were getting this from Korea, I believe, barley. I suppose you heard barley, they eat barley over there. That's
it's cooked the same way as rice.
And it's cooked the same way. The only thing is, you see, that barley is so rough on your stomach, so hot that you... I don't know what food that you could eat here that's so wicked on the stomach, you know, because it's too hot even for an animal over here. If you feed a horsey with barley, you get him sick.
Bloaty,
yeah. Oh, very, it's terrible. This is what I was trying to say. It's too acid. And, our boys used to get so sick of that stuff, they would upset your stomach and everything else, but this is what you'll get. And towards the end, this is what we were fed with, this barley.
And soup that we made from vegetables?
And soup is they call vegetable, is some tops of carrots or some other vegetable top that they'd bring you. There wasn't such, or they grew these big turnips down there, I don't know, they grew about 4 feet in length in the ground, you know. And then they'd bring one of these big turnips, you see, and the boys would cut that up and these leaves and throw that in there. And in time we used to get, they'd bring in bones of a horse, you know, hoofs and all. There wasn't, we otherwise we'd have never known. They'd bring the head, the hoofs and everything, but not a bit of meat on them, just plain bones, just like the skeleton. Bring that hoofs and everything, then you'd cut that up and the boys would throw that into this. Into the water and cook that, they call that soup, you see. So this was our soup, you see. My. There wasn't, I don't think there was food value in that, it's just existing, but as far as...
In 3D, were there bunks, or did you...
Well, there was, I'll tell you what kind of beds we had. There was 8 people sleeping down the bottom. It's a flat thing, on this flat. It's just like, what would you call it? It's one solid bunk, hey? Where 8 boys can sleep alongside of each other. And across from there, 8 more slept.
Would there be much room between you?
Hey?
Would there be much room between
you? Well, no, how? You sleep as close as you can? I mean, they weren't that tight together, no. But that's the way they were. And then there was another topper bunk, the same way. Side by, there was no dividing between men. This was all one flat, you see. So what we used to do, we were issued with these blankets from Japanese already, that Japanese army. And those blankets, they were made out of wood, far as I'm concerned, because you could throw it on top of you. And you know how a wooden blanket or a leather, well, it wouldn't even go around. You'd just lay on top of that like a chunk of leather or something. But there it was, you were glad to have that because just the real, well, that's what they said, this is made out of real wood. So you crushed up wood and that's they made up the blanket. And this is what we were covering up and this is what we had to sleep on. The bottom, all we had is this Japanese, one layer of a straw mat, just one thin layer of a straw mat. You lay on that and then you had this blanket to throw over top of you. So from about November till March, you were shivering like a dog all winter because there wasn't a bit of fire and it was always got cold like here in the fall, you know. Damp weather and cold and this is what it is.
There were 32 men in each hut?
Oh, no, there was 16, just a minute, I'll tell you.
One side,
16. Yeah, that's leaping across. One. This is the aisle here. He,
yeah.
The 16. Now we go down the aisle. Along this one hut had about 200, maybe 250 men. It's one building, but it's split up into sections. You see, you go down here. I can just show you just how it was built like. It's an aisle. You go down the aisle, and then every section started with one, and so on. You see? All right. So, all right. Yeah, I'll just make it out this way. Okay, there's your building here. He.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's your entrance. Let's see, there's your door here. He. And we got the door coming out here too, because there's an entrance on both sides. So we got a door coming out here. There's the center of the aisle right down here. He.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, like this. Okay, we split this into sections. You see, you got section one here. He.
Mm-hmm.
So. There's bunks here, bunks here. Then you go down here, you got another section here again. You see what I mean?
Right.
And there's bunks the same way over here again. Hey?
Mm-hmm.
Here, and here, here, and here. Which I did, I should have drawn them this way, here. That's right. Well, you understand. There's a, you come down here, there's an aisle coming in here, and an aisle coming in here. And then you come down here, an aisle in here, you know. Like that.
Oh, I see.
And you got bunks here and bunks there. And then come down here, an aisle here, and an aisle here, and this right goes right across like this. This is what they call a section here, see?
Right.
See?
So there would be eight in here?
There'd be eight sleeping here and eight sleeping here, which 16 in the bottom and 16 on top, hey? Okay? That's 32. And you switch over to this side and you got 32 on this side, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And then roll call comes in at the morning. First thing you get up, the Japs are there, roll call. So, okay. The Jap takes each section, you see, as he starts. Number one section, two, so on. So everybody stands and you have to call that in Japanese, you see. Like you're numbered off in Japanese all the time.
Right.
Like he starts, you start one, two, three, and so on, right around. And okay, then he marches to the next section. So he's got every guy's number. Because your name down there is number, not a name. So you get me all the tangled such a way to that. So that building holds a lot of men.
Were there any washrooms or just...
Well, then this thing comes out of here, you see, because there was two huts where we were. Like there was another one like that over here, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Now they had a washroom in between like that, see, in between the two huts. So you walk outside here and you go to this washroom where there's only taps, you see.
Right.
There's only taps there. You got your taps,
yeah.
And between the buildings over here, they had a pool built. See, and the thing was about 10 by 10 or 10 by 12 cemented pool, and they'd fill that maybe once a month. That's as often they'd fill maybe once a month or once every 2 months. Once a month if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, every 2 months. It put some warm water in that thing, and this group and this group, this is that one batch of water. You have to, the whole bunch has to go and have a bath there. So you know you jump in about maybe 25 guys at a time. You stand there like sardines. You think you can wash them and keep on going like that. So you can just imagine just what a setup that was.
There were two of these.
Two of these, then that washroom here, and that, and then the kitchen over here, you see? The kitchen sort of led from these huts, like, and the kitchen was built like that over here, you see?
Right, and that was all there was to the kitchen?
And as far as the kitchen was concerned, you know, they cook rice on these great big cast things, you know?
Barrels?
Well, did you see the rice cookers in any place there? It's a cast thing. It's sort of round. It's cast. It's not. It's well. Naturally, it's built out of cast. Great, big, heavy cast iron, and it's built out of that. They just heat those and they fill them with rice. You see, they pull the fire away, and that steams on its own. That's how they steam that rice there. That's how they get it so it's perfect. But like I said, the kitchen doesn't amount to nothing. Only a few of these steamers sitting in there. They are. They got everything cooked. And they use one of these cast things for cooking the soup, too, because they throw everything in there and that's it. It's
when the rice was done, you mentioned it was done well. How would that be? So it was dry and wasn't watery?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's when we were in Japan already, see. Yeah. That's how we were getting. Was it, when it's done right, it's dry, you see. And then you've got this soup or whatever you have with it. Don't worry, it couldn't get too dry because you're only getting a little bit of it, so you might as well say, I just looked at it and getting a good appetite and you have nothing left in the bowl. But oh, there was no worrying about eating it.
Would this be surrounded by a fence then?
Oh, this has got a... This had a fence with the electric wire around the top of it. And then it had guards. Oh, I'd say every 50 feet there's a guard with a guard housing. So there wasn't a thing that you could get close to any place. No way at all. Well, there was no easy escape again. Where would you go? A white man would show out on the outside of the fence there. They'd spot you like a big crow standing on there. There was no reason of trying to escape because there was no way going out of there. Because you were safer in Japan behind the fence than you were out of the fence because those civilians would tear you to pieces. That's how they were taught by their own people, you see. We were... But
Did any of the guards live in the camp? Or
oh, yes. Yes. Well, they had their own guard house. Apparently, they had their own quarters there, too, you see. This place, and there's another, like I said, these two big buildings where we stayed. Now, this place here, like, it belonged to Japanese, what they call their medical... where we went to see the doctor and stuff like that, and then the Japs had their place here where they changed guards, and apparently they had theirs where they rest and stuff like that. But they didn't actually live there. I think they had their own barracks out of there, but these fellows were changing, and apparently they had their own place to stay.
Was there any place for a garden or to grow any food here or a parade square or anything in 3D?
No. There's a parade square right there, like I showed you, see, in between the buildings, you see. There's that part there, I'd say, like that, you see.
Yeah.
That's the mountain, and that's the mount of the parade square here. That we had to go out. This is the only place that we can go out.
Yeah.
Around here, there wasn't too many of anything. Hardly anything. There was a little more room in behind here. There was enough room here where when the war broke out, they dug a hole for an air shelter for us. So, when the big air raids come over, that's where we used to jump in the holes. But I mean, there was no top to it. They'd just jump in the hole and watch the planes flying over. You had to be pretty quiet when you were down that hole, too, because the guys were standing over there with the bayonets. you couldn't smile if those fellows are flying and bombing it. Holy God, that was a dangerous spot. Outside of that, I
when you got up in the morning, you mentioned the three people would have to give up food. Somebody would go and get it. You know, that would change up. Is there any other kind of chore that we do? Somebody else would do, like maybe sweep the floor or anything like that?
Oh, yes. Every section had their own duty every day. The floor had to be kept clean. Any butts, you see, the guys had to look after the butts. You see what they call these ashtrays. Well, regardless what they had, because the boys used to even scrounge out there, you know, they'd always pick up some butts you weren't supposed to do, because if you ever got caught, you get a hell of a licking for it, because you get caught doing that. You always got an odd guy sells a shirt, gets a black market, gets some cigarettes, you see, and they'd have a little bit of smoke now and then. So every night, any ashtray that was around there, the guards made sure that they are carried out to the back of the bunkhouse. They had a certain place there. And every section on each one of those cans, section number was numbered on the can, you see. The guard goes and counts those cans, you see, and anyone that was missing, he'd wake the whole section up and ask, where's that cigarette thing? Don't you think everybody had to get up, and then one guy had to go and carry it? Oh, there was no fooling around with those guys.
Would there be anyone in charge of each section?
Any
one of you guys in charge of prisoner of war in charge? Or I know there would be Japanese looking after it, but...
A section, there was a section.
Did you
we had, no, we had every section. Every section had it, like we,
we had sergeants before, you know that. So anyway, he was appointed, and he was the guy that was in charge of that section all the time now. He was giving us the duties, what to do, what to, you know, every man had to do for the next day. But after it got so that you knew already, if today this guy is doing, the next day is yours, and so on, cleaning up this, or clean sweeping the floors, or, you know, there wasn't such a thing that you didn't know you're after you'd been there for a while.
Were there any windows in this?
There was, yeah, there was windows in those places. These are new places, they had the windows in there. But like I said, they also had stoves in the aisles here. You see, I could say maybe a stove here. Maybe there was three stoves in this place here, like this. But the only time they lit these stoves, maybe twice, once a year, when some big Japanese and Red Cross inspections coming over, so they'd make sure that they would put a fire on there. So if they open that thing, there's ashes, fresh ashes in there. We knew that. And that's all you've seen the fires. Put that fire there evening before that, and the next day, big parade going on there. Oh, yeah, they'd open up. Well, how would they know? Why don't they? And we didn't say a word. And when the inspection is on, they made sure we put on our clothes that were sitting on the shelf that day. That's the only day the inspection's on. And then it goes back on the shelf. We don't see it again.
This is when the Red Cross people would come?
Well, the Red Cross and big Japanese officials, you see, that they're showing them that the prisoners have been well looked after, you see. This is the... Well, that was quite a gamut, you know. These stores were never lit, you see, but this is one of those things that, like I said, you've got to go through a prison camp, live through it first, and you know what those things are for. They're not there. They're not there for you to get warm. They're only there for their purpose.
Yeah, to show. Yeah.
To show. That's
what
all
kind of stove was it?
Well, it's stoves like these, cast stoves like the CNR, you know, these long fellas like that,
yeah.
Where they used to feed a little coal into them. That's the type of a stove there. It didn't take much room, you see, that's where they put them over there. It's there. But it sure has been nice once in a while to get a little fire out of there, especially when it was good and cold and damp, and you come off to, when you're out working, you know, and you get chilled right through. But, this was one of the least things that... You expected us to get a little fire out of there because we never. Their own people that live that way, I guess that's the way. That's the way they figured everybody else should do.
Did you ever have any time for entertainment? Did anybody have a guitar?
Oh.
Well,
to explain you short, entertainment to us, we were barely breathing, inhaling your air. You weren't worrying if there was a music playing any place. This was the farthest away from you. All you were thinking of something to eat. You said, this is the thing that you were worrying about. That stayed.
Talk food.
Talk food and tease yourself all the time. Boys weren't talking nothing else but food. How they used to live, you know. And then we'd get this Red Cross parcel maybe once a year, you see, every Christmas. Well, you know, that parcel, I think it made more people sick than helped them because, you know, they dive into the rich food and what happens? That's diarrhea, they got everything, but what they shouldn't, you know, any chocolate or any of those meat that was in there, it was too rich because your stomach had lining left in it. Like I said, some of the food the boys looked after, it was nice. For me, I had lots of cigarettes, so what did I do? There was lots of officers there in 3D, and they were all selling rice for cigarettes, and I had these American cigarettes. God, I was getting a can full of rice, this tobacco can, you know, what is it, a pound? Well, that was once a day, you know, and that, I could feel it, that I was growing out of it. Just what cigarette did to me, see, brought me out of there. It might sound ridiculous what a cigarette will do. It'd kill a guy, and then it'd bring you out. Yeah, yeah, this is what it is. It's a...
Towards the end of the war, did you notice the Japanese attitude did change much? Did you get any better food or better treatment?
What if you shut that thing up for a minute for rest? Just a minute, where we're going to start.
The last thing I remember talking about was 5D, and then we somehow got on to the other camp and lost it. Do you remember moving from one camp to the other? Did you go by train?
Well, this is when we got moved, and why we got moved. This is air raid got so terrific. That, like I was telling you, that they kept throwing us in these shelters, but they were bombing them so heavy that there was no, I believe that they were, whether they wanted to save us, a few that was left, or it was, I knew that they weren't safe themselves down there. As I remember one day, night there, that the planes, I guess that was a routine all-night flight, and they're just continuously bombing. And we went to work 2 days later, and for miles, it wasn't able to identify a building, any place. You see, their buildings down there are built like haystacks here. One match sat off, the whole thing burnt off. You see, that's the way their buildings are. It's not, you know, just built out of paper, actually. The construction out of light wood and the rest of it is paper. This is what it is. And just like kindling, that stuff just went like, and like I said, we didn't go to work for 2 days. When we did go to work after, for miles, you didn't see only a knot of a tree here and there. No buildings, no people. Oh, the camp was all by itself. And sort of on a long side of the ocean, and there was a channel running in between it that we were protected from all the fires. The fires concerned, there was, unless you hit the camp, otherwise there was nothing there to be heard. And like I said, that's the only thing that they moved us out of there, that they couldn't work themselves because they kept raiding all night, and then the aircraft carrier planes flying over all day and shelling, you see, so there it was, it wasn't anything. So anyway, they decided, I believe, that they better take us out of there, and we went on the train for 350 miles north of Japan, into the little village. God, I forgot the name of that little village. But anyway, we were away from the village, it was right in the village, so that mine was a little away from the village, and this camp was set up, and there was a British troops, I don't know, about 400 of them, and there's about 400 of us there. Maybe not that many.
Before?
Maybe not that many.
Were you Canadians before you got there?
Oh, no. We were the only Canadians come in there, but the British were there. They must have got in there a little sooner than us. But anyway, there was maybe less, maybe about 200 Canadians come in there, because we split up. There was 500 of us in 3D, and then we split up all over. But then we went in these coal mines, and it's not a Canadian coal mine. It's the thing is that, I'm telling you, you go down these holes and look at the way that's braced. That thing can collapse any time, but this is their thing. And on the shift that I went down first, it was, I believe it was about 3,000 feet underground.
Did you walk down the elevators?
I don't know, you'd call this an elevator. It's a sort of a track car goes down. It's a side track car. Just you go down the shafts, but not straight down. It goes down, go down one way, and then you come back till you go way down different flights, but you still go on these tracks. I suppose you've seen those.
You would stand in or something?
No, you sit down. Just it had benches like two to a seat, like in school years ago. Same kind of setup. And these tracks go down there on a cable. Cable takes them down. We had time there that going down, that either the cable breaks or something goes wrong with the electrician, then you walk down or walk up. Something goes wrong with the. A lot of times, even the planes come over and they shut the electrician off, and then you got to walk up, you know, when they expect me here, because the lights, they shut all the lights up, and that's it. There's no more electricity, so you'd walk up. Yeah, you get down the mine, and right at the face where we worked, like I said, it's about 3,000 feet underground, and at the face at the coal mine, it's about 125 degrees heat. So the only thing that you can do is we stay there for about 3-4 minutes. You see, that's about as long as you can last, because there's no air, just heat. And you're in water about 12 inches with your feet, and all you've got is a pair of running shoes.
So, and that water is just as putting there as hot as the, that face is. So you can just imagine how long you can stand that. And like I say, we change off. We get out for, away from it and trying to get a hold of this pipe that's supposed to be sending some air, fresh air down the bottom down there, if you're lucky to get some. But that's the condition that you work. So we'd stay there for about 8 hours and just imagine coming out of there. And that was working during night shifts. Come out of there about 6 in the morning, which you're all played out, and the only thing that you've got to eat is a bit of that rice. And go to bed, and the bed, you know, it consists of a Japanese straw mat down there, which millions of fleas crawling over the top of you. And about 90, 95 degrees of heat. So we can just imagine with trying to get a rest and then go back in that mine at night again. So it lasted like that, but it got so we stayed there, what it was, 3 months. Within 3 months, well, things were getting hot style because the Japs were gathering up, you know, and we knew there was something cooking up in the air, and that's the time that they dropped the first bomb in Nagasaki, you know. But that didn't slow down. They stopped for a little while, but they kept going, never said a word to us.
Did you know anything about
that? We knew nothing about the first bomb. Then the next bomb came down about a week, 2 weeks later, I think. And they did the same thing. No bosses coming down to work. They left it by itself, you see. And so, by God, I think that same day or the next day, he said, well, they'll have to give up the war because they told us that... they remember how it was in the last World War that the gas was killing people up here. Now he said the Americans are doing the same thing over here, not with gas, but something worse yet. And we still didn't know it was this atomic bomb. I don't think they knew themselves what was the big thing like that that's blowing everything up like that. But that's where it ended up anyway. But like I said, another month or so, I think we'd have been still there, pushing the daisies. And, of course, it didn't take long for the guys to clear out of the camps because even the big officers of theirs just told them we better clear out because they knew that we'd get on the hot pad of theirs and grab their guns and go after them. And they cleared out of there. And then we were there for, oh, by God, for putting there 3 weeks in camp yet. But the Americans brought the supplies, food supplies.
What kind of contact did you have? Did they fly over and spot
the camp? Oh, apparently the Americans, the Japs must have told them where the camps are, where the prisoners are, because these big B-29s come over I don't know how many drums. They said they were carrying around 60 drums, these 45-gallon drums, and they were dropping them off 20 at a time, you know. Just imagine these big gasoline drums, and they were loaded with food. Well, some of them came down the ones that come down with the parachute, they were all right, but some of those that broke the parachute, they come down and crashed and nothing. But there was clothes and, oh, God, the Japs were bringing in them a week later, still bringing stuff out of the bush.
They would bring it into you?
Oh, yeah, the Japs used to bring it into the camp. Well, apparently they were scared of getting caught because they knew if the Americans ever spotted them with that stuff, where'd they get it? You see, this is... I guess they were scared because they were there, you see. They were taking it. Like I said, then we start getting a little bit of light. And it was about 3 weeks before we actually got a word that this train come in and we got on it. And all the way to Tokyo from there to 300 back.
What happened during that week? Did you eat pretty good food?
Well, it's all American. Sure, it was canned everything, you know. Meats and fruits and, oh, you name it, that was there. Barrels of gum, chocolate, anything that you, like I say, you name it. Clothes, barrels and barrels of clothes. Before we left the camp, we were dressed. And, you know, in 3 weeks, you get your stomach full a little bit and you're feeling a lot different and didn't work and the conditions were a little better.
Were you able to go out at all?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you wanted to, you can go any place else. I didn't go. Some of the fellas went out, but I figured I was just lucky enough to get freed without going and getting killed someplace else yet. Yeah, because it wasn't a place to get out there then. It's, you know, you're lucky to get survived to get out of there. And then we finally, we did, like I said, we got to Tokyo, and the Americans, they were pretty good with us. They went through the medical right there and then. They had a real setup, you know, putting us through the whole thing, and then oh yeah, everything was set up. You just went like you'd go joining the army. Now you have to go through the medical, well, like they say, a short medical, that to make sure that you weren't. And right away they gave us place to stay for a day, and then they put us on these. I went on a battleship of Iowa. We were there for, oh God, we were there for pretty much 2 weeks. Just anchored off the coast, off the Japanese coast. Holy, it was just, when I get on that thing there, it was just like landing in New York. I suppose you've heard of battleship, but you've never seen one. I never seen one myself. But we were there for 2 weeks, and we never seen everything yet. We had an escort, you know, the Americans gave us an escort. There was over 3,000 of crew there on that ship, you see, crew alone. So when the war was over, you see, these boys that were looking after guns and stuff, they had no work, so they gave us, every prisoner, an escort to show us around. So like I said, we were there for 2 weeks, and we kept going every day. They showed us different places, and just like a city, you just walk in, they got flights and flights and different guns and different setups, and it was quite an experience. And even getting on that, they give us $20 a piece, you know, right away. They said this is money is not to be spent, it's just to feel that you're at cost, you've got a dollar in your pocket. But any place you turned around, that you got it given to you. Carton of cigarettes, like I said, you want ice cream, you want drinks, it's there. You give it to you. Nothing you bought.
Did you come back by boat to
America? No, we were supposed to. They asked us whether coming back by boat, and I did put it in. I figured, well, at that time we looked like Japs. We had no hair, cut off right up, shaved up to the hair, to the scalp. So I thought, well, by the time we get back on the boat, which maybe a couple of 3 weeks, the fellow would look a little better, look like a man, maybe grow a little hair. And all of a sudden we got a word, we're going to fly back. And this is what happened. You know, they had no choice. They said, you guys are flying back. But it took time. We flew back to Guam Island. We stayed there for a week. Then from Guam, we flew to Hawaii. We stayed there for 3 days.
What did you do with each of these places?
Well, hospitalized, like you were put away, and you were being checked, you see, for diseases and getting needles. I think we looked like sieves by the time we got back here. Needles and pills, just, well, apparently anything, disease and vitamin pills and different kind of stuff that they were feeding us, just to bring us to, and then, you know, another thing is to bring anything into this country. Some poor, like Hawaii, it was the same thing. You're right away, as soon as you're off the plane, the ambulance are there, and they take you to the hospital, and then you're there. Your bed is there. So you can go uptown at night, but you're still back in the hospital. And then we flew to San Francisco. We spent a week there. But San Francisco was a little different. It wasn't a hospital. They put us in the army barracks already with the American soldiers. We spent a week there. Well, they took tourists around a bit, showed us.
Had you had any contact with Canadian government or Canadian
none whatsoever. Army? None whatsoever. Never seen a thing till then. They gave us the train from San Francisco to Vancouver. That was the place. Then the boys got off that train, kissed the ground, and said, "This is it. We're not leaving it." Yeah, that was the happy end of it down there when you got into Vancouver. Yeah, this is about as far as I can tell you right now. It's quite an experience.
What happened in Vancouver? Did we give them more medical treatment or welcome back?
Yeah, well, no, we just, we stayed in Vancouver. We didn't stay there too long. I believe we were there only 2 days in Vancouver. And then they boarded us a train all over to Winnipeg. Then you were on your own, go home.
Just go home? Were you released from the
service? Oh, yeah, right away. Well, you weren't released from the service, but you can go home, you see. with a bag full of pills and come back in 30 days, you see.
And how did you make out when you got back home?
Oh, well, which way do you mean?
Physically, you know, feeling well?
Oh, well, I wasn't myself comparing to a lot of them. Like I said, I maybe just the way I was brought up right from a kid, hard-boiled, like this wrestler was, hard-boiled Haggerty. I must have been brought up that way because I sure took a beating. And you know, I came back. It didn't take me long to get back in shape. Of course, after a while, sure, I had my... It took me pretty near 2 years. I was in and out of Deer Lodge, but finally I kept...
Right. How about pensions and that? Have you ever received any money?
Oh, I got pushed right out of hospital, which, you know, I don't know whether everybody does a thing like that, but they do that, I guess, in some of those doctors. My file wasn't finished up at all. I went to Deer Lodge, and the fellow says, well... you feel anything wrong? I said, not at the present. Well, he said, that's all right. He says, okay, you can go home. I said, you want to come back? No. This is all. And, you know, the file wasn't finished up because when I started getting sick after, and I went back, and it just happened that they didn't know room in Deer Lodge, and they put me on the... they had another hospital, an old folks place there from Deer Lodge where they kept them on the Broadway. Just forgot what we used to call it. It was on Broadway, I mean, anyway, not too far from Fort Austin Barracks. So, and there was another doctor in charge down there, and finally he got a hold of my files, you see. And he used to see me now and then, and I told him what troubles I have. And, so he asked me, who discharged you from the Army? So I told him, he says, God, he says, you know, your file is not finished up. He said, you had no business going out of there yet. He said, that thing, he said, I don't know who discharged you, but he said, you had no business going out of there yet. Especially discharged you from the hospital altogether, that the thing wasn't finished up. So he was type enough. He said, I can't see any of these Hong Kong boys can go out without the conditions you boys went through with malnutrition and all that. He said, so... he put me on 10%, I think. 5%. No, I believe it was only 5% that I got a hold of. 5% on the vitaminosis, you see. Then I had this rheumatism, which I got it, and I'll die with it. There's no cure for that kind of stuff. They call that fibrositis, you see. So I told them what the trouble I've got. So they finally sent me a bunch of stuff from Ottawa. Well, he said that you had that when you joined the Army. Well, apparently maybe I did say something like that. But that didn't improve, you see. That got worse because that condition, sleeping on that cement and stuff like that, didn't help any. That made it 10 times worse, you see. So and finally, I finally worked into another 5%. This was my big pension, 10%. Well, until recently, you know, when this stuff come on to... they put me on 49%, which everybody's supposed to get 50% because even on the convention, they said everybody was supposed to be on 50%. But I think we're still, I doubt it if everybody's on that yet or not. You know, any boys that sat back and not saying nothing and nobody's saying anything, this is the way it goes. Yeah, that's... And from now on, just like I said, carry on and live. Well, I'll tell you, it's towards the Army. I don't think that the Army is to blame for this setup of ours. It's the only man to blame is the fellas like the boys that come in from Jamaica that they serve down there and they come back here, which they were no more ready to go over to Japan or Hong Kong than I or any of these boys that served a couple of months here. Because they were only a guard duty man. They weren't a battle man at all, see? And this Hughes, what was his name, in charge of the battalion at that time, he is the guy that opened his big mouth and said, yeah, he's got a battalion ready. I don't think he's come back. He died. ran away. He's the guy that's responsible for this thing, because he had no battalion ready to go over there.
Right.
He only had 1,600 boys that come back from over from there. And where was he going to get the rest of them? He picked up that served a week, couple of weeks in the army. Picked up anything. So what? Who's to blame that the boys went over there? And like I said, you can't say that you can blame the government themselves. It's a, well, a lot of these government setup happens that way too, because the guy goes out of his turn sometimes, and then it's too late to cry over spilt milk, you see.
Mm. Do you have any ill feelings towards the Japanese at all? What happened to?
Well, you know, at that time, those Japanese are not alive anymore. Maybe there's a few is, the ones that actually were, to make the long story short, is they were brought up that way. Let's put it this way. When we got there, they had no knowledge of Canada or the States, how we live or anything. They figured that the way they live, that's the best living, see? We told them everybody in Canada wears a leather shoe or nice clothes and stuff like that. Well, they'd spit in your face because they couldn't. No, they figured the army is the only ones that the ones that can drive a car or wear a shoe or stuff like that. That's the way they were brought up all their lives. And you know yourself, anything that's done, this is the way they believe. They believe that after they surrendered. Now they know the difference, but I mean, at that time you couldn't blame them, and they were taught that the enemy is the enemy, see.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give up because you'll never eat rice anymore, stuff like that. Well, naturally, you know, they'd fight to their last. Like I said, even those guys come in Harry Carey, believed in the things so bad. But those things are, you can't, I can't say that I blame the Jap, no. The Japanese people are the same as any other human being, you know, if they were living like the rest of the people live. But, you know, the war is war. This is another, let's put it that way. That guy that's fighting against you, he's not to blame either, hey?
That's right.
And the guy that sent them down there is just like us. We went down there for no reason at all, and the same, that Jap fighting us is the same difference.
Yeah.
They never had a chance of winning the war anyway, but there you go. See, we never had a chance winning that one, and neither did they.
Yeah.
We're only a handful of men there, but like I said, it's... you know, the fellow just sat down and started remembering everything that was going on day to day. It's just terrible, that's all. It can't be worse.
I don't have anything more that I think we should talk about. I think we covered everything, but maybe you have something you want to say about.
Well, that's...
I mean, you're probably going to start thinking, gee, I should have said that and that, and I'm probably going to listen to the tape again and say, gee, I should have asked you that and that. But, you know, that's the way with every interview and every person I talk to.
Yeah, well, you see, you can't... like I said, you have to sit down and... if I had to sit down for a week and...
Well...
put it there, but you crisscross the things, and all you can say is this: you got that much, and the back. And, like you see, let's read the back line of that too. You know, there's so much to be added to it, and it's not that you can't remember the things that have been going on from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I can say: I wouldn't want anybody to go through that too. To get that experience that I've got.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
I can't even come close to trying to feel what it was that you first experienced, but hopefully after talking to a number of people, maybe it's not much.
Right. Like I said, I've talked to people around here, and I know if somebody, the only person that I can talk to, I've talked to a few people that were in prisoner of war of Germany, and those are the ones that I can tell them a few words, they just listen to it, and then if he tells me a few words, I do the same thing, because I know exactly the feeling, and I could picture it in front of myself, you see, just what the man goes through and what he did, and you know, But to picture to a people that lived here, never seen war, especially of Canada, you see, it's hard. You've got to go through it to understand. You just got to go through it. Because if you don't, you can't believe it that you can survive on such little thing and come out of it. And, you know, sure, there's people today say, well, look, what's wrong with that man? He looks all right. You know, there's things like that. But, you know, no feeling whatsoever, just...
No understanding.
No, they can't. You can't. You can't believe, you can't blame them either, because, you know, it's... Well, I gently wiggled myself out of it. I said, well, if it's so nice, if I look so nice, and you figure that pension is good to me, I said, there's the Vietnam Wars on you. You want to go enjoy it for a while and find out what it feels like. Yeah, well, that's about all you could say. Yeah, I guess maybe you can just shut that up now.